Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. Bringing you this next episode is my researcher, Brittany Martinez. She spent a lot of time researching and writing the show notes for this case. I know that she's very excited and nervous to deliver this case to you. So without further ado, here's Brittany.
Some of the most infamous American mass murders are the ones that take place in a school. Columbine, Sandy Hook, Virginia Tech. Schools are supposed to be the safest place for children next to their homes, so it's always devastating when an incident challenges that belief. However, despite the country's obsession with these types of crimes, the deadliest mass murder to happen at a school is often overlooked. On May 18th, 1927, a small farm in Bath, Michigan exploded and caught fire. As citizens rushed to the home to try to save its residents, another explosion was heard in the distance. It came from the direction of the Bath Consolidated School. The explosion was soon followed by the screams of children. Over 500 pounds of dynamite had been meticulously planted in the basement of the school by Andrew Kehoe, the owner of the farm on fire. Arnie Bernstein, in his book, Bath Massacre, America's First School Bombing, describes a chillingly foreboding incident that happened on Independence Day, 10 months before the bombing. On July 4th, 1924, blast echoed throughout the farmland surrounding the Kehoe place. These were no ordinary stump-blasting explosions. Any passing fool might have thought the Great War was being reenacted on Kehoe's property. The ruckus put a scare into Sidney and Charlotte Howell. When they asked Nellie Kehoe about her husband's unconventional fireworks, she jokingly calmed their fears. "The little boy's having some fun," she said. Okay, on with the show. Andrew Philip Kehoe was born in Tecumseh, Michigan on February 1st, 1872, to Philip and Mary. He was one of 13 children who grew up on his family's farm. As a child, Kehoe developed an interest in electricity. He was also a quiet child who often preferred to be alone rather than with other people. Andrew's mother died when he was 18 years old due to a disease of the nervous system. From descriptions, it sounds like it was MS or maybe ALS. His father remarried a much younger woman named Frances Wilder, a widow with several children. Andrew hated his stepmother, and they constantly fought. Andrew left home and went to school in Lansing to study electricity. He worked odd jobs, and at the age of 40, Andrew moved back home to help his father with the farm. Philip's arthritis was so bad that the farm would have completely deteriorated without the help of Andrew. Despite having grown older and presumably more mature, Andrew still had a tumultuous relationship with his stepmother. To make matters worse, he had a new baby sister, 3-year-old Irene, who was young enough to be his own daughter. The home had a tense atmosphere that must have been thick enough to choke on. Sunday, September 17th, 1911, Frances and Irene had spent the morning picking hickory nuts. Time got away from them, and Frances found herself rushing home to make lunch. Andrew and Philip were already home. Little Irene went outside to play while waiting for lunch. The scene quickly changed from an idyllic Sunday with the family to a horror movie. Frances went to the stove to light it to begin making the meal. As she lit the stove, flames engulfed Frances from head to toe as she was covered in the oil used to fuel the stove. The extreme heat from the flames caused the water inside Frances's body to boil and her skin to melt like candle wax. Little Irene was the first to follow her mother's screams to find her burning to death. Next was Philip, who urged his arthritic body to move faster the louder his wife's screams became. Last was Andrew, who, when he saw his stepmother, threw water on her to stop the fire. Water, however, is the worst thing you want to throw on a petroleum fire. The water actually caused the fire to spread further across Francis's body. Eventually, the fire was put out, but the horrific damage was done. Andrew and Irene took Francis's burnt, smoking body to the bedroom. Any small touch to her body caused Francis to moan in pain. The Kehoes did not have a phone, so Andrew and Irene walked to their neighbor's house to call a doctor. Hetty Murphy, the Kehoes' neighbor, recalled Andrew being calm as he asked her to call a doctor and a priest. She had no idea the situation was as dire as it was. The doctor and priest arrived to find Francis little more than a blackened lump on the bed, who was sobbing in agony. The doctor knew he could do nothing for her and watched as the priest gave her last rites. Finally, Francis succumbed to her injuries. It wasn't until after the bombing of the Bath Consolidated School that people began to wonder if Andrew had a hand in his stepmother's death. Shortly after his stepmother's death, Andrew rekindled an old relationship he had at college with a woman named Ellen Price. Ellen, who went by the nickname Nellie, was the niece of a successful businessman and politician from Lansing, Michigan. On May 14, 1912, just 7 short months after the gruesome death of his stepmother, Andrew married Nellie. They began their marriage living on Philip Kehoe's farm, where Andrew continued his work with keeping the farm going for his sick father. Philip Kehoe would die on January 8, 1915. Andrew and Nellie moved to Bath and lived on Nellie's uncle's farm. They had worked out a deal with the family that the Kehoes would buy the farm from the family's estate. The total cost would be $12,000, $6,000 as a down payment, and the rest to be paid with interest as a mortgage held by Nellie's family. His new neighbors thought Andrew was a strange man who didn't wear overalls while he farmed and spent all his money on fancy farm equipment, but nevertheless was a polite man willing to extend a hand of help when asked. Andrew was also considered the go-to man for dynamite, as he became an expert using the material for removing stumps off his property. It became commonplace for Andrew's neighbors to hear him setting off several large detonations on his property, or see him coming back from Lansing with several cases of dynamite and detonators. In 1921, the city of Bath passed a bill saying they were going to build a consolidated school for the children. Currently, there were several smaller schools that children went to that put all kids, regardless of age, in the same room to learn. The child just went to the school that was closest to them. But a consolidated school was a step in the direction of modernity, as children would be grouped by age and taught material suitable for their age. The town would have to raise a considerable amount of money to pay for the school, so a new tax law was passed for the citizens of Bath. Andrew Kehoe, a man known for his shrewdness, did not care for the new bill and the taxes that it enacted, and fought it from inception to passing. After the law was passed, Andrew Kehoe still wanted to be a part of how the money was set aside for the school was spent. He ran for school board treasurer under the coalition that the school board needed new leadership. He won a 3-year term. Kehoe was a meticulous record keeper and would balance the books down to the penny. It was this reputation that led him to being appointed town clerk when the former town clerk unexpectedly passed away. Andrew was finally in position to make some real change in the community. As much as Andrew's meticulousness was a blessing, so was it also a curse. He was constantly in fights with the school board and the school superintendent, Emery Hike. Emery drew most of Andrew's ire, but Andrew didn't do himself any favors by going toe-to-toe with the school board over transportation bids that he felt were driven by nepotism rather than what was the best financial decision. Emery Hike was a wonderful superintendent who was constantly pushing for accreditation for the school, something that Andrew Kehoe saw as Hike just trying to spend more of the town's money and overstepping his role. A year after being appointed the town clerk, Andrew lost the position during the general election to another member of the community. It's clear that part of the reason why Andrew lost was due to his contention with the school board. However, Andrew kept a calm facade in public and didn't challenge the election. He attended every city council meeting where he would sit quietly in the audience with his wife. In the summer of 1926, Nellie Kehoe started to become sick. The color drained from her face and she had difficulty breathing. Andrew spent a lot of time taking her back and forth to hospitals and doctors in Lansing. Doctors would diagnose her with tuberculosis, then change the diagnosis to asthma. Really, they had no idea what was going on. Regardless, the once social Nellie left the house less and less. It took a toll on Andrew, who, by this time, had stopped paying the mortgage on the house. When confronted by a lawyer from his wife's family's estate, Andrew blamed the school taxes on why he couldn't afford the mortgage. The Kehoes were in no danger of eviction, however, as Nellie's family would not cast out the sick woman and her caretaker husband. Once described a polite, even friendly neighbor, Andrew's relationships with the citizens of Bath began to crumble. The school bus driver said that Andrew would be outside his house every morning with a watch to make sure the school bus was running on time. Another neighbor told a strange story where Andrew tried to sell him an old horse for $125. The neighbor declined, even after much pressure from Andrew. A few weeks later, Andrew came by the neighbor's farm with the horse and left him there. The neighbor understood the gesture to be a gift, until Andrew showed up with a bill of sale and demanded $125. Andrew's reputation as a man willing to adopt new technology and his education on electricity gave him the opportunity to do some odd jobs for the school. Andrew liked doing so because it saved the town from having to pay a professional. It also gave him unbridled access to the school, particularly its basement. May 18, 1927, began with fire. At 8:45 a.m., Andrew Kehoe detonated the dynamite he had planted throughout his entire farm, including the barn. It was later discovered that Andrew had wired everything for complete destruction. He chained his horses to the barn so they could not escape and made sure his farm equipment would be destroyed in the flames. The first neighbors to arrive were searching for Andrew and Nellie, but could not find them. Their search was cut short when they noticed the large amount of undetonated dynamite that was laid throughout the home. Neighbors and firefighters tried to put out the fire at the Kehoe farm, but were soon distracted by large explosions that came from the direction of the school at 9:45 a.m. Prior to the bombing, Andrew had spent months carefully filling the basement of the school with hundreds of pounds of dynamite. Fortunately, only a portion of the dynamite Kehoe wired for detonation actually exploded. Investigators later found 500 pounds of undetonated dynamite intricately wired throughout the school. Despite only a portion of the dynamite going off, the results were devastating. First grade teacher Bernice Sterling recalls, "It seemed as though the floor went up several feet. After the first shock, I thought for a moment I was blind. When it came, the air seemed to be full of children and flying desks and books. Children were tossed high in the air. Some were catapulted out of the building. The explosion caused the north wing of the school to collapse, leaving only a back wall standing. Descriptions of the destruction are absolutely horrifying. Monty Ellsworth, a neighbor of the Kehoes, recounts, "There were piles of children of about 5 or 6 under the roof, and some of them had arms sticking out, some had legs, and some just their heads sticking out. They were unrecognizable because they were covered with dust, plaster, and blood." The body of 7-year-old Doris Johns was suspended in the rubble by her feet in plain view until someone could get through the debris and dislodge her body. 6th grade teacher Eva Gubbins was trapped in the rubble, her legs pinned under a concrete beam. To her horror, she also realized the body of one of her students was crushed under that same beam against her legs. The most heartbreaking story belongs to teacher Hazel Weatherby. Hazel was found deep in the rubble with bricks burying her up to the waist. In her arms were 2 children, both dead. Rescuers gently lifted the bodies of the children from Hazel's protective hold. As soon as her arms were empty, Hazel Weatherby died. Superintendent Emery Hike stood out as a hero of that day. He coordinated the rescue with the adults. At one point, he was begging children not to jump out of a second-story window, instead asking them to wait for ladders. The children didn't want to wait, however, due to the floor they were standing on becoming increasingly more unstable. Despite the children not heeding Emery's warnings, serious injury was avoided. Emery also took it upon himself to coordinate phone calls, even calling the State Department and State Police himself. He was a cool head during a frantic situation, and the amount of lives he saved is immeasurable. When Monty Ellsworth was driving to his farm to get ladders and ropes to help with the rescue, he remembered seeing Andrew Kehoe driving in the opposite direction toward the school. He grinned and waved his hand. "When he grinned, I could see both rows of his teeth," said Ellsworth. When Andrew arrived at the parking lot of the school, he must have been thrilled at the sight. Rows of dead and injured children were lined up near the school. Mothers were hysterically crying as they checked the bodies one by one. Fathers were frantically digging through the debris in hopes of finding their child. When Andrew saw Superintendent Hike, he waved him over. A witness claims that once Hike was near his truck, Andrew pulled out a rifle and shot into the back seat. The back seat of Andrew Kehoe's car was filled with dynamite as well as pounds of metallic debris. The gunshot ignited the dynamite, and the debris, acting as shrapnel, tore through anyone unlucky enough to be standing nearby. Emery Hike and Andrew Kehoe were killed instantly, as well as Postmaster Glenn Smith and Smith's father-in-law, Nelson McFerrin, who were there to help with the rescue. Also killed was Cleo Clayton, an 8-year-old boy who had managed to pull himself out of the school and collapse in the school parking lot, only to be struck down by the debris from Kehoe's truck. The force of the explosion was so strong that the fragmented bodies of Kehoe and Hike landed 60 feet from Kehoe's truck. Kehoe's body was identified by his driver's license, Hike's by the tattered remains of his jacket. Otherwise, they would have been completely unrecognizable. Automobiles that were parked near the truck caught fire. There was unbelievable carnage left in the wake of the truck bomb. Chunks of human flesh were hanging off telephone wires. Hardly anything was left of Kehoe's truck, but it was clear that a tangled mess of intestines were wrapped around the steering wheel. At 10:45, a difficult decision was made. Because of the discovery of unexploded dynamite throughout the school, the search for children had to be called off until the area was deemed safe. A state trooper and an engineer worked together to carefully disarm all of the dynamite. However, there were some places that were too small for the men to squeeze their bodies through. Enter Chester Sweet, a 14-year-old boy whose younger brother and sister attended Bath Consolidated and were injured in the blast. Chester squeezed his body into tight spaces and carefully removed the dynamite he found. In all, 504 pounds of unexploded dynamite were found throughout the school. It was estimated that 100 pounds did explode under the north wing of the school. Had all of the dynamite gone off like it was supposed to, it's reasonable to assume that there would have been almost no survivors. By the time rescuers were able to focus their attention on Kehoe's farm, it was completely burned down. The only thing left standing was the chicken coop, where rescuers found an undetonated bomb. Nellie Kehoe was still missing. Police and firefighters combed through the debris, but could not locate Nellie's body. There was some hope that maybe Nellie had made it out or was out of town. That hope was dashed the next day on May 19th. Rescuers realized that Nellie had been there all along, right under their noses. Her body was so badly burned that the countless people that walked by her didn't realize there was a body. She was found with her arms tied to the axle of a makeshift wheelbarrow. Her left arm lay over the axle, completely loosened from the shoulder. Her right arm was bent backwards, bones shattered. It's unclear if it was the fire or violence that caused the damage to her arms. There was also a crack on Nellie's forehead. It's unclear if the crack was caused by blunt force trauma or by the brain expanding and turning to gas under the intense heat of the fire. However, it's generally accepted that Andrew Kehoe bludgeoned Nellie to death and left her body to burn in the fire. At the edge of the farm, searchers found a sign left by Andrew Kehoe. Angrily stenciled on a wooden sign was, "Criminals are made, not born." It's amazing what a tragedy can reveal in people. The community of Bath, as well as surrounding communities, came together to help the dead and injured. People were driving children in their personal vehicles to the hospital. Homes were opened to act as triage centers. Comfort was offered to those that were grieving. On August 22nd, a little over 3 months from the bombing, Beatrice Gibbs would go into surgery to remove a splinter from her hip. The fourth grader arrived at the hospital in awful shape. Both her legs were broken in two places. Her right leg had a large gash. Her left elbow was shattered with another break right above it. She had a laceration to the back of her head, and her body was covered in cuts and bruises. Doctors could not wrap her broken body because the wounds needed to be closely monitored. She spent those 3 months in a complicated bed frame with her body suspended from ropes and held in place with 35-pound weights. Gradually, the weights were reduced as her body tried to stitch itself back together. No matter how much healing took place, Beatrice was in terrible pain. She succumbed to her injuries the day after her surgery on August 23rd. She would be Andrew Kehoe's 44th and final victim. Andrew took with him 38 children and 6 adults, with 58 injured. Nellie Kehoe was laid to rest in her family's plot in Lansing. Her headstone reads Ellen Price. Andrew Kehoe's remains were put into a coffin, lowered into the ground, and then covered with dirt. There's no headstone. No markings of his grave. If you're interested in learning more about the Bath Massacre, I highly recommend the book I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, Bath Massacre, America's First School Bombing by Arnie Bernstein. Bernstein did amazing research of the book, and it is filled with eyewitness accounts from the day of the bombing, as well as photos of the town, the school, and the victims. If you read The Professor and the Madman, our July pick for the True Crime Fan Club Book Club, then head over to our discussion page on Facebook to talk about the book. I can't wait to hear what you guys have to say. Also, I'd like to announce the selection for August. I want to shake things up a bit and choose some fiction. The August selection for the book club is Heartsick by Chelsea Kane, a bloody crime thriller that centers around a damaged cop and his obsession with the female serial killer who let him live. I want to thank Lainey for giving me the opportunity to cover this fascinating story. And I really want to thank the True Crime Fan Club community for welcoming me with open arms. This has been such an incredible experience so far, and I feel like a very, very lucky lady.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast app of choice. It really helps us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCPod, Facebook.com/TCFCPodcast, Instagram TCFC_podcast, and of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request or general suggestion, you can send us an email, TCFCPod@gmail.com. I would like to welcome to the club our most recent Patreon supporters, Kevin M., Haley Gray, host of the new podcast Murder Road Trip, Linvia M., and Rachel S. Rachel is also the winner of our True Crime Clothing Giveaway, so congrats to you again. Our music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams, who created custom music just for us. Check them out on Twitter, at We Talk of Dreams. Research and content editing for this episode was provided by Brittany Martinez. Audio engineering was provided by the talented Nick Bryant. To discuss this episode, please be sure to join the Facebook discussion group where we can discuss the cases more in depth. Just search for True Crime Fan Club Discussion Group and one of our lovely mods will add you. One more exciting announcement. I'm starting a second show. It's called We're All Just Pretending. It's a podcast version of Dear Abby with a twist of Post Secret. Every episode, I will read listener questions and provide advice and insight or share your anonymous secret. Please send in your questions and secrets by going to our website, allpretendingpod.com. And remember, we're all pretending here. While you're waiting for the next episode, check out some of my pod friend shows.
Hey guys, this is Mandy and Melissa from Moms and Murder, a true crime podcast featuring two moms who think they're funny.
Trust us guys, we are. Join us each week as we discuss both the infamous and unfamiliar stories in the world of true crime.
You can check us out on our website at momsandmurder.com and also connect with us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
We release new episodes on Tuesdays, so we hope you'll check us out.
Hello, fellow true crime fans. My name is Joel Micah Harris. I host the podcast This Week in True Crime History, which takes a look at the horrific real events of years past on the week of their anniversary. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. Until then, stay safe.
Murder Road Trip is a true crime podcast where I, your host Haley, discuss murder cases in my car, aka the Mobile Beats Lab. Join me and my partner in crime, H.H. Gnomes, on the road. There will be games, mixtapes, and snacks as I make the research journey to murder scenes around the world. Make sure to check your back seat, and I'll see you at the next rest stop.
Hey guys, this is Sinead from the Mens Rea podcast. If you like true crime, and I know you do, check us out to hear about the guilty minds of Ireland and the UK and the court cases that followed. Available wherever you get your podcasts from. And remember, don't do anything I wouldn't do. Thanks.
Welcome to Film Roast.
Hey everyone, Hannah here, the co-host of Film Roast, where two over-caffeinated and underqualified friends talk about all things movies. If you like film factoids, lots of sarcasm, and bad impressions, check us out on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter, @FilmRoastShow, and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/FilmRoast. Happy roasting!